He unwraps the crackers and nibbles them down meditatively, drinking the rest of his water. Tomorrow, he knows, if he is still here, he will have to eat snow for water, or fill his water bottle and somehow try to melt it. By bringing it into his home, he thinks. But he has little choice. Before dusk, he takes one last look at his tree and his efforts to tighten and insulate it. He cuts more boughs, but in the oncoming cold it is only minutes before he starts to shiver. The shaking drives him back inside. With less than an hour of searchlight left, Milkovich radios down his worry. Since their freshest clue is the location of Jason's car, a clue 4 days old, Milkovich knows Jason could be anywhere. A healthy hiker can cover a lot of ground. And from what they have heard, Jason is young, reasonably fit. And there are more than enough trails in those woods to choose from, and to go astray. He tells dispatch to call search and rescue. What they cannot do from the air, they may be able to accomplish on foot. They are going to get searchers into those woods. Milkovich knows that on a search like this one, it would be best to get as many feet as possible. They are all volunteer, and at any one time he can only expect a partial response to his call. But tomorrow is Saturday, he thinks. The weekend could be in his favor. Better call him out, Milkovich finally advises Lake County Dispatch. Maybe the ground pounders can turn up something. Pat Lowe and the tired spotter angle their wings westward, and in the day's last light, return to Chicago base. Lake County Dispatch signs off and starts the page. When the directive comes in over Jim Williams's pager, he is winding down his Friday labors. By 3 p.m., his latest remodeling effort is coming to a close, at least for the weekend. When his radio pager beeps, he recognizes the voice of the Lake County Sheriff's dispatcher.
"Calling Two Harbors Search and Rescue," she says. Her voice crackles over the small device. "Please report to the garage for a wood search."
She repeats the directive and then signs off. Since its inception over 3 decades ago, Lake County's volunteer search and rescue has grown progressively more sophisticated. In the late 1950s and 1960s, it was little more than a group of concerned citizens. Today, the 50-plus volunteers are divided into 3 squads, Two Harbors, Silver Bay, and Finland. Each squad has trained individuals who can stand in as incident commanders, the leaders responsible for guiding and directing searches. And now the volunteer groups have plenty of the right equipment. All-terrain vehicles, ATVs, personal watercraft, and boats. Gear for water searches, wood searches, climbing rescue. Radio equipment. Even their own command vehicles. The Finland squad's vehicle is a used ambulance and trailer, gutted and refurbished with communications gear, a table, and a sleeping berth. Two Harbors has an emergency van specifically manufactured for search and rescue. The equipment is a far cry from what the volunteers scraped together just 2 decades earlier. Among the group of altruistic citizens, there has been talk of more training. Most of them have attended CPR and related courses. And most of them, either by practice or on the job of an actual search, have acquired reasonable familiarity with handheld radios, diving equipment, climbing ropes, carabiners, helmets, wood search packs, and assorted other equipment. But Jim Williams, the head of the Two Harbors unit and the first commander to answer the sheriff's page, knows there is little substitute for practical experience, particularly in the woods. He and his sons, Darren and Ryan, also volunteers on the team, run a construction company on the edge of town. Jim and his boys mostly remodel, though he also owns the Minnesota distributorship for pre-manufactured log homes from a Canadian outfitter. As he winds through town, he wonders who is lost in the woods this time. It doesn't take long to reach the Two Harbors search and rescue garage, where the group's equipment and emergency van are kept. Williams is on the phone getting more information when his son, Darren, walks through the door. Jim smiles and nods. His sons love the woods as much as he does. When calls like this come in, it is difficult to keep them out of the fray. The dispatcher doesn't give him much additional information. Jason Rasmussen is lost on the powwow trail. Jim doesn't recognize the name, so he suspects an out-of-towner. Almost all their search and rescue involves people unfamiliar with the woods, usually from the cities. Every year, hikers come up, claiming they are knowledgeable and prepared, and then they go missing. Fortunately, Jim Williams knows these woods as well as people from the cities know their streets.
The dispatcher tells him to take the van and head to the trailhead parking lot, where Under-Sheriff Steve Van Kekerix will meet them. Sheriff Steve Peterson is out of town and won't be back for at least another week. Van Kekerix has all the information about Jason, the search, and what has already been done. Jim Williams signs off, and he and Darren get into the van, starting the 70-mile drive north. They are joined by Jim's other son, Ryan, and six others from the Two Harbors squad, all in their own vehicles. Jim knows the Silver Bay and Finland squads will also be answering the page. By the time they hit the north end of town, it is 5 p.m. Williams knows that area around the powwow and the old Forest Center site well. The summer of his 17th year in 1963, he cooked and made coffee for the crews of Tomahawk Lumber, which operated the town of Forest Center. He drove plenty of lumber trucks on the back roads out of the small lumbering community. He remembers the town, its chapel, small cafe, grocery store, lumber mill, and pulp operations. It was the site of an old Civilian Conservation Corps camp before the town started. For 25 years, Forest Center was the logging train's last stop. There was a school, too, with classes through the sixth grade. Beyond that, kids had to be farmed out to relatives down in Two Harbors or boarded in local homes. The distance from Two Harbors to Forest Center was too far, and the roads too rough for daily trips. Forest Center supported at least 70 families. At the time, the log harvesting practice was to set up remote camps from a base, work the area for a year or more, and then move on, setting up another camp somewhere else. The men headed out on the trails to remote logging camps at places like Calamity Lake or Crystal Bay, now well inside the Boundary Waters borders. The theory was that, in the years it took loggers to circumnavigate a logging center, the trees replacing the ones they'd cut down would be ready for harvesting. The reality, of course, was slightly different. In the end, Tomahawk Lumber ran out of trees and time. Williams graduated from Two Harbors High School and made his first professional purchase, a chainsaw. He knew the area and was ready to log. If Tomahawk hadn't been on the verge of bankruptcy, the company would have hired him. But they folded in 1965. He found plenty of other logging work, and for the next couple of summers his young chainsaw hummed. Then, the Wilderness Act was passed and Forest Center and everything around it closed up and moved away. But if you wanted to build a complex maze in the woods, with sucker trails and misplaced routes, you would be hard-pressed to improve on the region. Williams has crisscrossed the bogs, swamps, and woods his entire life. He has mastered compass and map. He has perfected a way of moving through woods, whether along trails or in rougher terrain, in strides that are almost precisely 3 feet long. There are 1,760 yards in a mile. With a compass and his map-reading skills, it's likely that Jim Williams could pinpoint an area in the middle of dense woods with as much accuracy as a handheld GPS. When asked about getting lost in the woods, Williams is matter-of-fact and self-effacing. "I've never been lost, but I've been confused many times," he explains. "I was a timber cruiser." In those days, the only maps were aerial photos. You had to be accurate with what you were doing. I trained myself to take 3-foot steps, and I was fairly accurate with where I'd be. But you have to pay attention to the wind, sun, terrain, the trees and streams. If you're observing those things, other things, there is really no reason for someone to get lost. Williams knows many hikers enter the woods unprepared, whether physically or psychologically. When people are lost, he's used to hearing families say that they're experienced hikers. "That may be," he says, "but they're not experienced woodsmen." Most of the people they search for are like Jason, urban people. The city, Williams says, is a place where I'm just as far out of my element as hikers are when they get up here. Jim, Darren, and Ryan Williams, along with the other Two Harbors searchers, reach the trailhead parking lot well after dusk. There are a handful of others assembled from Finland and Silver Bay. They have already done some preliminary searches along the nearby trails. They have signaled with heavy sirens and flashing lights, but there is no response. The call has gone out for dinner, for 15 volunteer searchers must be fed. Some are still in the nearby woods. Others are milling around, waiting for their first crack at pizza. When the searchers have assembled, Steve Van Kekerix is joined by Rebecca Francis, the U.S. Forestry Service law enforcement officer. They tell the group what they know. Steve and Rebecca explain where Jason went in, how long he has been gone, when he was supposed to return, and where he was going. Van Kekerix has already spoken with the parents. In fact, Steve is heading over to Ely from here. The parents have come up from the cities and are staying in an Ely hotel, ready to help out with more information or by entering the woods themselves if need be. Everyone knows that's a bad idea. The best thing the parents can do is let the pros handle the search and rescue. Steve Van Kekerix is already mulling the delicate diplomacy he'll use in his conversation with the Rasmussens. He has plenty to share about what has already been done, and the number of search and rescue folks who have answered their page. He is hoping the kid's parents can tell him more about the maps he is carrying, his equipment, and his backwoods savvy. It sounds like Jason Rasmussen is experienced, fit, and more than equal to surviving in the woods. He appears to have the right equipment and plenty of food, and he's a med student. If he has broken a leg or is wounded, he should be able to keep himself alive. But they are all troubled by the failure of the day's flyover efforts. Steve tells them the Forest Service plane has covered every inch of that trail and much of the area inside and out of it. But they didn't see a thing. Not a tent, not a hiker, not even tracks. Deputy Milkovich will be heading up tomorrow to spend another day in the air, but they need some ground pounders in those woods to see if they can find something, anything. It's a puzzle. All of them, seasoned woods people and those familiar with the area, know anything could have happened to Jason. He might have fallen into a bog, slipped and dropped into a ravine, broken a leg, sunk to the bottom of a lake. They hope their imagined calamities are just that. Imagined. Jim and Darren will spend the night in the van, just in case Jason comes out. But it is cold tonight, Williams knows. In this first good snowfall of the season, most critters will be hunkering down. Jason would too, he suspects. Van Kekerix, Rebecca Francis, and the other searchers leave. Everyone promises to return at first light. Over cold pizza, Jim and Darren Williams plan Saturday morning search. Jim peers out at the place he knows they will search first. These first obvious places are referred to as hasty searches. Seasoned rescuers know hasty searches have the highest likelihood of getting results. In the morning, they will be ready. 16. The OPP Emergency Rescue Team. Quetico Provincial Park. Friday, August 7, 1998. At 3 a.m. on August 7, Jeff Moline, a constable with the Dryden Detachment of the Ontario Provincial Police, is awakened out of a deep sleep. The goddamn phone is ringing and it sounds like an alarm going off in his head. His hand reaches to stop it. He brings the receiver to his ear at about the same time he musters his single-word response.
Yeah.
Jeff Moline? The voice asks. Moline barely manages an affirmative.
Out of bed, Moline, someone on the other end of the line directs him. We've got a scout lost in the Quetico.
Moline recognizes the dispatcher's voice, but can't come up with a moniker. He is still groggy, not entirely certain he's awake. Get your crew and report down to Atticoke and Lickety-Split, the voice commands. We'll see you there in 4 hours, he says. It is the Dryden on-duty communications specialist. Moline still cannot remember his name, but he manages a dull, okay, then hangs up. The OPP has two emergency rescue teams, each comprised of 16 men. Moline and Kevin Hunter, out of the OPP's Thunder Bay Detachment, are the two search coordinators for Moline's team. Jeff doesn't know if this search will require a second team, unlikely, but he knows there will be at least 16 searchers heading into the woods. Jeff's team would be assembled from the other detachments, Atticoken, Fort Francis, Kenora, Dryden, Red Lake. In all, there are over a dozen detachments from which the members could converge. Given their locations across the massive Ontario province, they will arrive in Atticoken at different times. Atticoken is the central point for this operation because it is perched like a tiny bug atop the million-plus-acre Quetico Provincial Park. It takes a little over a minute to drive through the town. Apart from the hospital, a few bars, a half dozen stores, and some lumber mills, The Ranger HQ and the OPP station are just about all there is to the place. Moline knows everyone on the ERT will follow the same process. Review the case, learn about Moline and Hunter's plan, after they create one, and head into the wilderness to help set up a base camp and start searching. Moline, like everyone else in the ERT, knows that every minute matters. By the time Moline wipes the sleep out of his eyes, he is already on the phone to Scott Moore, the other ERT member from the Dryden detachment.
"Look for me within half an hour," he tells Moore.
In the middle of the Quetico night, Dan Stevens stirs. This night, his coiled bark and pine bough bed is rough and scratchy, but relatively mosquito-free. He doesn't actually sleep. He enters a kind of half-consciousness in which his tired body rests, but it is not sleep. He feels a large ant or spider move across his legs. He feels a point on his abraded skin where something bites him. He flinches under the microscopic jaws. He wriggles to be free of it. He closes his mind, trying to reach toward darkness, to find rest. But it is a long time coming. He feels more of these critters crawling on him. He wonders if he has lain down on some kind of anthill. He made sure his bedding was bug-free before coiling it around him, but he guesses they are attracted to his legs. He has been careful about drinking. Now he is going to pay for his compulsive hydration. He has to peel out of the bark coils and throw off the boughs. He tries to do it carefully, because he knows in just minutes he will have to crawl back inside. He pees and looks at the stars. They are brilliant in the cool August night. He focuses on the North Star, high in the sky, but still pointing north. He finds another stick and lays it down, pointing toward the bright sphere. In the morning, he reasons, he will use it to double-check his coordinates. He will have three pointers, one marking east-west, tracking the setting sun, one laid perpendicular, pointing south, and this one pointing north. They should all line up. If they don't, he knows he will have to reconnoiter. But he feels better now that he has a plan. He is confident his markers will align. He is about as comfortable as you could expect, recovering from a concussion, lying on the ground in tree bark with black spruce boughs for bedding, surviving a cold northern night in a light shirt and shorts, not having eaten anything in more than a day. His stomach gnaws at the thought of food. He tries to recall everything he knows about wild food. He believes he remembers reading about the inner bark, cambium layer, of northern white pine. It can be harvested and chewed. He also recalls arrowroot and knows he has crossed through plenty. He resolves to try both in the morning. Then he crawls back into his birch bark coils and gathers the pine boughs and broadleaf around him. Later in the night, he feels the ants crawling. One crawls near his arm. He reaches down, picks it up. But instead of smashing it with his hand or brushing it away, he feels the large black shape wriggling, recognizes the outline of a large carpenter ant. And then he pops it into his mouth. He bites and swallows, and in darkness feels a satisfying twinge of vengeance at having turned the tables on at least one of the gnawing beasts. Dryden to Atikokan is almost 200 miles. With enough coffee and the right wheels, you can run it in a little over 3 hours, providing you are willing to bend the rules. At this time of night, on this emergency, Moline's only worry is a big mammal, moose, deer, or the rare woodland caribou, straying out of the woods. They take Trans-Canada 17 almost 18 miles to Provincial Highway 502. There they settle into a comfortable ride for almost 100 miles. This highway is broader than 17, safer given their speed, and they make excellent time. Moline's trip is made only marginally easier by the company of Scott Moore, the other ERT member from Dryden. The two men hurtle through the dark Ontario night. Not long after starting on the long haul down 502, Moore nods off. Moline turns from 502 onto East Provincial Highway 11. He guns the last 85 miles in just under an hour. At that time of the morning, he sees only the occasional oncoming car, but thankfully no big animals sticking their wary heads out of the thick bush. They arrive in Atikokan before first light, right on schedule. Before leaving, Moline was briefed on some of the details. Now he knows he wants to be in the woods with base camp set up no later than noon. They will have to hustle to make it. In the hours before dawn, Dan Stevens tries to return to sleep. As he begins to drift off, he does not think about God. If he paused to consider, his heart might fill with recrimination. Instead, he feels determination. He knows God has provided him with everything he needs to survive. God has done his part in this bargain. Dan has the resources of the woods, water to drink, and the know-how to put it all together. In the bush, Dan reasons, everything watches out for itself. Unless you get in step with the wilderness program, the bush will devour you whole. He wants to assuage his parents' worry. He wants to stop the search and rescue he suspects is being waged on his behalf. He doesn't like to think about the time and money being spent or of his parents' anxiety. He can imagine them in knots, fraught with fear. He wishes he could reach out and let them know he is fine, that he can walk out under his own power. He wishes they would call off the search, but knows it is an idle thought. They will search until he gets out under his own power and lets them know he is okay. Hungry, but okay. A little torn up over the legs, but otherwise fine. Now Dan Stevens knows he needs to rest. He is determined to execute the plan he feels certain will take him to safety, and not make mistakes. Sometime before dawn, he dreams. Fisher map F-19 is laid out over a huge table. He cannot see the edges of the table, but knows the portion of the map in front of him is the country he now traverses. He stares at the map, searching for the point that will show him, "You are here." But there is nothing. He again notices the lakes spread across the map in a northeast to southwest direction. There are no topographic numbers, no indications of elevation. But he realizes, staring at the map in his dream, that the ridges he is now crossing must conform to the striations of water. They move in the same direction. On the dream map, he notices a series of ridges and valleys before encountering Otter Track Lake. Before the dream evaporates, he makes note of the realization, and in the morning, he remembers. At dawn, he throws off the coils, rises, and crests the ridge, dropping over the other side. He watches the sunrise, shivering in the early morning cold. It was a reasonable night. No rain, with temperatures in the 60s. It was hard sleeping. He was too keyed up, ready to get underway. He shivers now, starting to feel the sun warm him. He takes note of the sun and lays another stick in an easterly direction. He marks the location, comparing it to the three sticks he laid last night. He wants to be absolutely certain of his southerly direction. The pointers line up, and he crosses back over the ridge. He looks out over the low slope of land. In the distance he can see two small ponds, connected by small creeks, laid out in a southwesterly direction. Halfway down the slope is a large white pine. Dan starts down the hillside toward the tree. He is ravenous. He opens his knife blade and digs into the fragrant wood. He peels off the outer layer, revealing the resinous white cambium. It smells strongly of pine. The smell reminds him of solvent or air freshener. But he is hungry. He peels off a long strip. It is like a damp length of flattened baling twine. He puts an end of it in his mouth and starts to chew, but it is like chewing on a piece of pine saw soaked leather. He tries for almost a minute, trying to gag the bark down, then spits it out. There is a little water left in his canteen. He drinks a mouthful, swishes, and spits, trying to get rid of the bitterness. He turns and continues down the hillside, moving into the lowland, alert for berries or anything else he can eat. He is careful to keep the landmarks in front of him, the ones that guarantee his southerly direction. In the lowland he finds occasional thimbleberries. Most of the ripe ones have been eaten by the birds or bears. Some have fallen on the ground. He gathers a few near-ripe ones and devours them. They are sour. He sees a few on the ground, eats those, and is thankful for their sweetness. He is especially thankful that the taste of the berries overrides the bitterness of white pine bark. In the morning, Constable McGill and Staff Sergeant Donald brief the assembled team at the Atticoken station. They explain everything they know about the case, where and when Stevens disappeared, Stevens' experience, what the group was doing in the Quetico, the fact that his friends left him, the location of his friends now. They cover it all in detail, answering ERT members' questions. Moline has chartered two beaver planes to take them into the bush. They will set up base camp at No Name Lake, at the precise location Stevens walked into the woods. He has also requisitioned the OPP's helicopter, which will take a while to arrive from Sudbury. This time Scott Moore pulls the lucky job of spotter. It pays to have one of the search coordinators come from your detachment. After Moore helps set up base camp and determines a likely landing spot for the OPP's twin-engine Aerostar copter, he will be searching from the air, not bushwhacking through that part of the Quetico. There will be plenty of searchers on the ground. Moore has done it often enough, and he smiles to know that this time he will have the bird's-eye view of the place. At the Atacocan OPP station, somewhere after 7 a.m., the shifts change. Sergeant Heather Lacey replaces a tired Phil Donald. Jim McGill has already shared everything he knows with the searchers and Sergeant Lacey. McGill has gone out for donuts and coffee. In all the planning and preparations, McGill and Donald haven't had a chance to get back to Stevens's parents.
"I'm on it," Lacey says.
She doesn't look forward to calls like these, but at least she can inform the Stevenses about the OPP's efforts. The small Atacocan station is humming with ERT staff. Supplies are being gathered and packed. Dogs have been sent for. And the first beaver has arrived. The first contingent of four ERT members is ready to load and take off. Everything that can be done is being done. A little after 8 a.m., Sergeant Heather Lacey calls Jim and Marianne Stevens. It has been a bad night for the couple. Jim Stevens stared in the dark, trying to imagine his son's whereabouts, to place himself in the Quetico woods, about which he knows nothing. He is familiar with wilderness, but from what Dan told him earlier that summer, northern wilderness seemed wilder than the southern woods. Everything but the water has a sharp edge, and there is too much water. He has looked at the maps. He cannot believe the latticework of lakes and streams. There is as much water as land. He hasn't said it to Dan's mother, but with so much wild water, drowning is a possibility. He knows his son, knows he is an excellent swimmer and waterman, careful about life vests. Still, with that much water, anything is possible. A bleary Jim Stevens answers the phone after the first ring. Heather Lacey introduces herself and the Ontario Provincial Police. She is barely into her discussion about what is being done before Stevens has words of his own. "We're catching the next flight up," he says. He knows he cannot spend another night in the dark without shut-eye or any sense of what is being done for his son, without doing something himself. Sergeant Lacey assures him that they are doing everything that can be done. She tells him she will contact them every hour and give them updates until they find Dan. At this point, it would be premature for them to come to Canada. They would be helping Dan more by staying home, attending to their move, giving the OPP any other details they think might be relevant. Stevens is doubtful anyone could turn over as many stones as himself, the boy's father. But he spends the next half hour repeating everything they have already told Doug Hurdler. They are impatient and anxious. But to Jim Stevens, who has an ear for bureaucratic mumbo-jumbo, Heather Lacey sounds granite solid. They are relieved to have the staff sergeant on the other end of the line, and for now are convinced to remain home by the phone. Throughout the warming August morning, the two yellow beavers ferry men and supplies into No Name Lake. Moline and Moore are among the first to arrive. They fly low over trees and water, examining the entire shoreline of Fran Lake, No Name, and Bell. The place is nothing but trees and brush. They can barely discern where the waters of No Name Lake begin and the brush ends. They are looking for some kind of granite promontory or high ridge outcrop, the best place to be seen, providing Stevens is still around and thinking clearly enough to make himself seen. The pilot makes two passes over the lake, but there is nothing open about it. From the air, they believe they can see where the portage should be in the area where Stevens disappeared. The plane makes one more wide circle and lands on the lake from the northeast. The pilot taxis the float plane down to the far southwestern corner. Moline and Moore see the wide cobblestone path at the far end, the one Stevens was first certain was the portage. And then, almost 50 yards to the southeast, the wide, dark spot and the opening into the cedar swamp behind it. It is the only place that looks like a cave, the way the Chattanooga fathers described it. Behind open space, cedar boughs close overhead in a dense wall. Inside, under the boughs, everything is dark. The first thing they are going to do, Moline knows, is hike into that dark space and explore every cranny of it. The float plane taxis up to the open edge of water, and the men throw off the rope and tie it firmly ashore. They take no more than 5 minutes to unload supplies for base camp. Tents, coolers, food, bags, radio equipment. Everything is tightly packed and easily handled. When it all sits in a huge pile on the shore, the float plane is untethered and cast off. In moments, it wings back out over the lake. As part of the initial search coordinator setup, Moline and Hunter have laid out a search grid. The grid is divided into kilometer-wide squares that stretch out and away from the point where Stevens walked into the woods and disappeared. By now, Dan has been gone 2 nights, approximately 36 hours. That means the search area is going to be wide. When they unfold the map and examine it, the expanse of wilderness is daunting. Moline, Moore, and Hunter realize that if Stevens hiked north, he is in a world of hurt. That direction disappears into over 15 miles of heavy bush until the next big body of water. And that's if he hiked due north. People in woods without anything to guide them, like a compass, tend to walk in circles. If they are left-handed, they tend to veer left. It makes them walk in a huge, left-leaning circle. Right-handed people veer right. Eventually, most people pushing through brush end up at or near the place they started. Due north from Bell Lake is one of Canada's thickest, most impenetrable forests. Nothing but big trees, thick brush, black flies, and mosquitoes. The likelihood of coming in contact with any wilderness travelers would be 1 in 1,000,000.
More like 1 billion, Moline thinks, given the fact there are no good canoe routes and certainly no hiking trails.
A hike north is a walk into oblivion. In terms of woods and distance, the hike south doesn't look much better. But at least in that direction, he has a better chance of running into someone, providing he can hike all the way to the Canadian border. The search team has spent enough time in the Quetico woods to know the likelihood of making it all the way to the border, to the long, narrow strip of Otter Track Lake that straddles the international boundary, is at best remote, more likely impossible. Even if Stevens knows what he's doing, the hike would be through bush so thick and bug-infested, most would be turning in circles and unhinged within 24 hours. Stevens went into the woods without a compass or map. That means dead reckoning via the sun, most likely, providing Stevens is savvy enough to compensate for the rule of dominant-handedness. He has the season working to his advantage, but even in August it gets cold at night, and the heat of the day, particularly at dusk, will bring out the swarms. He might find some berries, but more likely he'll go hungry. Damn hungry. Moline knows the woods have plenty to offer, if you know what to look for. But it takes training and time to recognize the possibilities. The kid might know something about it, given his background and Eagle Scout rank. But people more experienced than Dan Stevens have walked into the woods and disappeared. All in all, they're not feeling good about this search. The team is well rehearsed in setting up camp. By noon, the entire place is a hive of activity. They have already been over every inch of the Cedar Swamp and the surrounding area, but they find nothing. Not a track, not a sign that the young man has passed. They're disappointed, but not surprised. Searches of people gone as long as Stevens rarely have a rapid conclusion. Some of the men are already in the woods starting their search along obvious routes. They have ferried in dogs, and the dogs are trying to pick up Dan's scent. If he is in the neighborhood, Moline knows, the dogs will smell him. The helicopter is almost in from Sudbury, but they realize there is no good place for it to land. The area around No Name Lake is so thick with brush, trees running straight up to the edge of the water with no flat granite outcrops. They will need to create some kind of makeshift helipad. Sergeant Norm Mitchell and Moore know the copter doesn't need much, but it should be plenty open, so the rotors have no chance of hooking on a tree branch. The most open place close to camp is the cobblestone end of the lake, but the boulders are too large and tumbled, in the same state the glaciers left them. Its surface is too uneven. A kind of log dock landing pad could work. It doesn't have to be much, just spread in an even plane across those boulders. Mitchell and Moore envisioned the way the logs could be cut, stripped, and laid out in a simple latticework across the open rocks. 2 long log sides with 4 logs strapped across it. They enlist the help of 4 recently arrived ERT members and make their way along the shoreline to the cobblestone end, sizing up trees as they maneuver along the tight bank. While the men build the makeshift helipad, The copter touches down at the Prairie Portage Station and picks up Jerry Wills. He is amazed at the copter's speed. In minutes, they pass over the 27 miles of terrain that had cost hours of back-breaking pain and labor the previous day. They fly low over the southeastern end of No Name Lake, where a yellow beaver lies tethered near the shore. Jerry points out the location where Dan Stevens disappeared, now occupied by the ERT. The pilot radios the ERT ground crew and then ferries Jerry Wills back to Prairie Portage. By early afternoon, all 16 ERT members have arrived, dropped off their gear, and started searching. Jeff Moline and Norm Mitchell are setting up gear, waiting for the Aerostar twin engine to reappear. They've been in radio contact with the chopper and expect to see it any time now. Moline and Mitchell consider the handiwork of their makeshift helipad. They have both seen the copter land on worse. And within the next half hour, the copter has put down, picked up Scott Moore, and taken off over the lake, making a wide circle of the entire shore, the most obvious place anyone could be seen. Moore and the pilot have the grid laid out in front of them. They make several wider circles of Bell Lake, but even when you're on top of it, you cannot see much more than the conical tops of pines. In another half hour, they exhaust the local possibilities. They radio to Kevin Hunter that they are turning south. For the rest of the day, the dogs and men search through the Quetico woods. Scott Moore and the copter pilot make several runs south, covering different grid quadrants all the way down to Otter Track Lake. But it is as though the trees have swallowed Dan Stevens whole. Even the dogs find no trace of him. 17. No tracks, no signs, nothing. The Powwow Trail Region, BWCAW, Saturday to Sunday, October 27 to 28, 2001. Saturday morning at first light, there are over a dozen searchers assembled. Jim Williams is serving as incident commander. Rebecca Francis is there to co-command and make sure proper wilderness authority is available in case BWCAW regulations need explaining. ATVs and overhead planes are entirely allowable, she assures them, in cases of search and rescue. Brad Johnson, a DNR conservation officer out of Silver Bay, has also answered the call. He was patrolling the area when he heard the radio chatter. In less than an hour, he is in the trailhead parking lot, ready to hike into the woods. Together, Williams and Francis send pairs of searchers along the obvious routes, some in ATVs, others on foot. Most of them head up the trail. The initial goal is to circumnavigate the entire powwow. They need to walk every foot of it, since the trail is the most likely place Jason could be found. But the early going is difficult. The weight of the heavy, wet snow has clogged the trail and bowed many of the young trees bordering it. The trees and brush have to be shaken and flung upright to make way for hikers and four-wheelers. Each pair has a woods pack containing waterproof matches, medical supplies, food, water, and space blankets, durable foil sheets designed by NASA that retain almost 100% of the body's heat and fold up into 2-inch squares. If Jason is out there and in trouble, they have plenty of the right resources to assist. And they carry radios that can bring down a swarm of rescuers on the spot, if need be. Last night the weather moderated, and now it is hazy and beginning to warm. The heavy, wet snow starts to melt, growing heavier with each hour and making walking more difficult. The Rasmussens stop by in late morning. They meet with Stephen Van Kekerix, Jim Williams, Rebecca Francis, Brad Johnson, and some of the other search and rescue folks. Van Kekerix makes the introductions, and they all share their initial progress. The officials encourage the parents and reiterate their full expectations of finding Jason alive. But while they review what they've already done, Williams hopes no one calls in from the field to report a body has been found. Off to the side, a handful of searchers have returned empty-handed from their first forays up nearby trails. Quietly, they are beginning to suspect the worst. More than a day of extensive flyovers have yielded nothing, and in nearly perfect conditions. Why didn't they at least find Jason's orange tent, or some other sign in the wide blanket of white? They know that in 90% of search and rescue cases, the hasty searches done nearest the last whereabouts are successful. The odds are not in Jason's favor. 6 days gone without any clue but a cold, dark metal heap.
still empty in the trailhead parking lot. The searchers hang on the periphery, waiting to convey their empty-handedness and get their next assignment, which they suspect will be more remote. Until now, Jason was just another lost person. Now the searchers see Linda and Lee's anguish. It makes their efforts somehow more tribal, as though seeing the family reminds them of their own, makes them recollect their natural communal connection. It could be anyone out there. Someday it might be one of their sons or daughters, brothers or sisters. Perhaps it is these silent doubts the Rasmussen sense. Their presence impedes the freewheeling discussion of the search efforts or any talk of recovery of the body, if it should come to that. Lee and Linda again describe their son's experience, intelligence, and drive. They convey his preparation and the types of maps he carried with him, details Williams and Francis already know from their discussions with Van Kekerix. In the end, the Rasmussens know their son is better served by their own retreat to somewhere off-site, and they decide to drive south to Two Harbors and find a place to spend the night. All day the searchers ply the nearby trails. Two pairs reach the juncture of the circular trail and head in different directions, hoping, by late afternoon, to meet somewhere on the west side of the trail. But it is a long hike, and not easy in this snow. Before their routes are half done, they are forced to turn back, exhausted and discouraged. By late afternoon, the most remote half of the trail hasn't been touched. Hiking is not easy, either plowing through the accumulation or recognizing the trail through the trees, especially in blowdown areas. Jim Williams and Rebecca Francis have been at the command center the entire day, tracking the searchers' progress, getting periodic radio reports from the field. Overhead, Pat Lowe and Nick Milkovich have been crisscrossing the sky since first light, but there is nothing to report. No tracks, no signs, nothing. Jason Rasmussen shuffles around his hollowed-out home. If he had an aerial view, and if his orange tent fly weren't smothered in snow, he would see he was less than half a mile from his camp, and less than 6 miles from the swarm of people now assembled in the trailhead parking lot, spreading into the woods like trailing ants. But he would also see the difficult nature of the terrain. As the crow flies, it is a short distance to safety. But for all the bogs, swamps, beaver ponds, and thick forest brush he would have to cross, providing he could maintain a straight line and knew which direction to turn, it would be impossible to hike it in a single day. And he would get wet. Jason remembers his wilderness survival book back in the tent. He was reading the section on hypothermia when he finally noticed the rain had stopped. He had folded the corner of that page and set the book down. The natural sequence. Exposure. Hypothermia. Disorientation. And death. But that was a lifetime ago, he thinks. 3 times he has heard the drone of an overhead plane. He has been careful to scramble to the nearest brush opening. But the opening is small, and the flights are not directly overhead. He waves. At one point he climbs on top of the 6-foot stump beside his hollowed-out home. When the beaver comes into view, this time nearer than any of its previous flyovers, he waves his arms and shouts. He is a full 8 feet closer to the plane, and at least from a sideways vantage, eminently more visible. But if you saw Jason from the air, you would see a man in olive drab, the color of trees and brush, standing atop a stump wide enough to conceal his every gesture. He would have been far better off standing on snow. Nick Milkovich and Pat Lowe see nothing. In the plane's wake, he whistles and whistles, but there is only the gradual ebbing of the plane's engines. Any hopefulness he was feeling at the start of the day bleeds out with the passing plane. By the time his narrow opening returns to silence, he begins to realize it may be another day before he is rescued. His disappointment threatens to plummet into something much deeper. If he is not found this day, he knows he will have to spend another night in his tree. He recalls the adage, "Idle hands are the devil's workshop." He busies himself making more repairs, sealing more holes, covering over more cracks. The effort makes him light-headed, and later in the day he begins to feel weak. He knows he is starving. He hasn't had enough water or food for at least the last 3 days. Finally, by late afternoon, he opens his small tin of tuna. Canned tuna has never smelt so good. The salty sea smell wafts into his forest opening like ambrosia. When he digs it out of the can, it flakes off on his fingers. At first, he tastes it carefully. He sucks down every particle before returning to the tin for more. Its saltiness makes his stomach weak. Then he takes one large bite. He tries to chew it meditatively, but cannot help himself. Within 5 minutes, he is licking the can, careful not to cut his tongue on the tin's sharp edge. Now he is thirsty. He cannot believe how much his throat burns for one long drink of water. It is in part the effect of the salty tuna, in part the cumulative effect of 1 cup of melt water per day. Now he eats snow to slake his thirst. He packs his remaining water bottle with snow. He begins shaking. He suspects it has as much to do with the salt intake and his need for water as the cold. And eating snow hasn't seemed to help his thirst. Well, after dark, he lies inside his tree and continues to tremble and sweat, feverish in its wooden heart. On Saturday night, B.J. Kolstedt and her husband John return from a week in New Orleans. Kolstedt is one of Finland's key search and rescue personnel. Unlike Jim Williams, she is not a native northern Minnesotan, but she is one in spirit. When she was a senior at Lakeville High School down in the cities, her science teacher took a group of students on a 1 week course to the Environmental Learning Center, ELC, just outside of Isabella. For an intensive week, Kolstedt traipsed through sub-zero temperatures and deep snow, observing white-tailed deer. Her fellow students complained, longing for the warmth of their own beds, the restful sanctuary of their homes. B.J. Kolstedt's eyes opened to the northern starlight. In the transcendent beauty of winter wilderness, she found a calling. After graduating from the University of Minnesota Duluth, she managed to find work teaching at the same ELC she visited when in high school. Over the years, she added an EMT certification to her credentials, and she has been working on the search and rescue squad out of Finland, not far from home, for the last several years. BJ is one of the few volunteers who has had extensive training in search management systems. Every year, the second weekend in October, the Emergency Response Institute offers a class, Managing Search Operations, at Vermilion Community College in Ely. This year, BJ taught the course. It was another opportunity to augment her expertise on the topic, and it is a great place to meet others in the field. On her last trip, she met Carla Leahy and Carla's friend, Sherry Wright. Both were dog handlers, part of Central Lakes Search and Rescue, an organization outside of Bertha, Minnesota, that uses dogs to search for people, dead or alive. For the weekend course, she also enlisted the assistance of her old friend, Wendy Dean, of North Star Dogs. Wendy and her dog Cassie demonstrated how trailing dogs work in the field. As soon as John and BJ walk in the door, she listens to her messages. Before her bags are unpacked, she is on the phone, inquiring about the search status. It is 8 p.m., and IC, Incident Command, conveys the troubling message. The day has yielded nothing.
"What's being done tonight?" she asks.
"As far as I know, nothing."
Dispatch explains that Jim Williams is up on the trail, sleeping in the van in case Rasmussen walks out on his own. But they fear the worst. The whole area is quiet as stone. BJ is eager to put her learning to work. In some areas, searchers will only go into woods during the day, but BJ knows there is plenty that can be done at night. Not only planning the next day's searches, but also performing other hasty searches in nearby woods. Some searchers prefer the woods at night, when their lights are prominent. They can see a fire a long way off, and the woods are quiet. Sound seems to travel farther in the dark. She also remembers, from her friends with the dogs, that the dogs prefer going out at night. They work better in the dark. Scent settles in the night. But she has just returned from a trip, and she needs to unpack and get ready for the morning. She tells IC she will be at the trailhead parking lot by first light, ready to lend a hand. She volunteers her husband John to go with her. He doesn't take much persuading. Then she signs off and hurries her chores, knowing she should get some sleep. If Jason altered his expected route or took a wrong turn, he could have ended up near Isabella Lake, or south along one of the other routes out of Old Forest Center. Just after dawn, BJ and her husband are hiking through the nearby woods and along Isabella's shoreline, looking for signs. Rebecca Francis and Jim Williams are back at it, assigning pairs to hit other areas that hadn't been crossed. Sunday morning dawns clear and warm, at least warm for this time of year. The relative warmth feels good, but intensifies the melt. Hiking through wet snow is like slogging through sand. Williams knows they won't be able to get to the western side of the trail. He is particularly interested in sending a team up Superstition Spur, since Jason mentioned to his mother he might hike up that trail if he had the time. Williams enlists the Forest Service plane to fly two pairs of searchers into Lake 3 near the northwestern corner of the trail. Brad Johnson gets in, with Richard DeRozier, a Lake County deputy out of the Silver Bay Squad, Ron Van Bergen from DNR Fisheries, and USFS Forester Terry Olson. Johnson and Olson will hike due east over the trail, as far as they can, given their time constraints. DeRozier and Van Bergen will head south towards the Superstition Spur. It is almost noon. In the plane, Deputy Milkovich and Pilot Dean Lee explain their strategy. While the searchers hike, they will be taking advantage of the good weather, doing more flyovers of the area, hoping for some kind of break. "If you don't want to spend the night in these woods," Milkovich warns, "make sure you're back at the pickup point no later than 4 o'clock. The two teams are clear about it. They have no intention of spending a cold winter night in these woods. The trail is almost impossible to follow, but both pairs of searchers are experienced, and they manage to pick their way along the east-west and north-south quadrants. Once DeRozier and Van Bergen get out of the blowdown, they make good time south. They radio in every half hour, but there is not much to tell. The open parts of the trail are beautiful. Apart from wet, cold feet, they are enjoying a great day hiking in the woods. Their exertions, combined with the day's moderating temperatures, actually make them sweat. But they don't find any tracks, tent, or any other sign Jason has stepped through these woods, and they don't have enough time to make it up the Superstition Spur. Another pair of searchers head in the direction Jason said he would take, moving along the trail counterclockwise. But instead of turning to Pose Lake, they keep heading north, taking the Lake Insula Portage Trail. This is the juncture that first lured Jason off the powwow. Midway to Lake Insula, the pair of searchers pass Jason's camp and fire pit. But it is still blanketed with snow, and they find nothing. They keep heading north, exploring the old portage all the way to Lake Insula. Then they turn around and start back, radioing in their coordinates, conveying the absence of any signs. Throughout this day, Jason, too, has enjoyed the sunshine. His fever broke before dawn. He crawled out of his tree feeling tired and weak, but better. Throughout the day, he has witnessed several flyovers, summoning the strength to wave and whistle each time they pass. But he knows they don't see him. At midday, he walks to a nearby clearing. He finds an open log to sit on. It is warm enough in the forest opening to doff his boots. He tries to warm his feet in the sun and dry his boots. He pulls out the liners and replaces them with dry grass and small spruce sprigs, hoping they'll make better insulation. He still cannot feel his toes. Later in the day, he returns to the tree. The plane has crossed over him so many times he wonders why they haven't seen him. For perhaps the first time, he wonders if he will ever be found. He thinks about it abstractly at first, as though it couldn't possibly be this incident's conclusion, the expiration of his life. He doesn't want to be found months, maybe years later, withered in this distant spot, stumbled over by a moose hunter or some other bushwhacking hiker. He thinks he understands death, that he is equal to wherever death will take him. But when he considers the possibility of not being found, waves of love and concern for his family, his sister, his mom and dad, crash over him. He doesn't want to disappear without at least some final communication to them. He has a pen. He forages the woods for some adequate birch bark and begins writing a goodbye letter to his folks and his sister. He considers his words carefully. He is still writing by the time night forces him to suspend his effort and return to his tree. He was able to melt about one good cup of water in the sunlight. It was sweet and delicious, but barely enough to keep him going. He has packed his water bottle again and brought it into his hovel. The bottle full of snow is cold comfort through the night. Back at the communications van, there is plenty of activity that evening. The searchers have all reported in. There is nothing south of the trail from Lake 3.
The East-West team made it all the way to South Wilder, but the trail was untouched. Another team heading west on the northern part of the trail got to South Wilder, so the entire northern stretch of the trail has been searched. Nothing. The two remote search teams were picked up by 4 p.m. There was nothing along their distant stretches of trail. No tracks, no signs anyone had hiked that way since the snowstorm. The typical post-search process involves debriefing incident commanders on where search pairs have been and what they've seen. The pair who passed over Amu Creek report the same results. Nothing. They are wet and tired, ready to head home. It is a sentiment everyone shares. In 48 hours, the ground pounders have exhausted the trail and found zilch. Back at the parking lot, a pall settles over the remaining searchers. The Rasmussens have returned to the cities. They believe the search is continuing. They just have to return and let their employers and neighbors know what's happening. To date, Steve N. Kekerix has done an excellent job keeping the effort out of the press. The last thing any of them wants is reporters on the scene, bird-dogging their efforts. The searchers are unsure about where else they should search. They feel as though they have exhausted all the obvious possibilities, and then pursued the most unlikely. Everyone is wet and tired. Finally, not ready to give up, but too tired to continue, they decide to call off the ground search. For now. At least for now. That evening, when Steve Van Kekerix phones the Rasmussens to let them know the ground search has been suspended, he is quick to mention the continuation of the air search. The plane will be back up at first light, Van Kekerix says. If Jason is moving, he repeats in a phrase the Rasmussens have heard before, we'll find him. And the Minnesota Department of Transportation has an air wing helicopter that can make overhead scans of large tracts of wilderness for thermal signatures, Van Kekerix explains. He has scheduled the chopper out of Cloquet. It should be reviewing the entire area overnight. If Jason is out there, he repeats, the air wing should pick him up. Back home, the Rasmussens return the phone to its receiver. This news is devastating. They understand it, and they are thankful for all that has already been done. But while searchers were still combing the area, there was hope. More hope, they know, than if the air search continues alone. And what if the air wing chopper finds no heat trace of Jason? Now the only thing connecting them to Jason is an infrared thermal device and a beaver plane with two spotters. They cannot properly absorb this recent shift in events. Since Jason's absence, their sleep has been scant and fitful. Now they turn to their bed in silence, unable to speak, knowing it will be another long night. After dark, up in the trailhead parking lot, the place is empty, except for Jason's patient Saturn, still sitting, waiting in the cold and dark. After a late supper, B.J. Kolstedt is restless, unable to go to bed, though she is exhausted from the day's search. She is nagged by a recollection from her recent search management class about statistics on lost people. People with Jason's experience, fitness level, and background almost never get lost because they fall and hurt themselves. They are too fit. It makes her suspect he may still be out there. Statistically, the Jasons of the world lose themselves by taking a wrong turn and continuing in error. Widen the search area? Reconsider the maps, looking for obvious points to go astray? Finally, she phones Pete Walsh, the current captain of Finland Search and Rescue. Coincidentally, this weekend, October 27 to 28, is one of 2 weekends a year Pete is required to work. Usually he is laboring Monday through Friday, helping maintain Lutzen Resort. The oldest resort in Minnesota, he claims. He has been around long enough so no one questions the assertion. Pete was one of Finland Search and Rescue's charter members. 25 years ago he helped formalize the volunteer squad, and over the years he has spent as much time fundraising and investing in the squad's equipment as he has in the field. It was he and some fellow volunteers who gutted and refurbished the old emergency vehicle, setting it up with communications equipment, a table, a bunk, and other necessary supplies. It is old, but operational, and just one of the efforts that gives him pride. This evening he is just about ready to turn in from a long work weekend at the resort when the phone interrupts him. It is BJ, one of his favorite volunteers.
He has heard about a search for someone up on the powwow. Although he has lived on the North Shore his entire life, he's not that familiar with the old forest center or the